Good morning. We are on the downhill part of this, okay? We have a little review we do, as you know. Our goal is at the end of this, we can all know them, and we can beat the averages in the nation. First word is, I'm the Lord your God who brought you out of the land of Egypt. First commandment is, no other gods in my face. Second commandment is, images. Third commandment is, Lord's name in vain. Fourth commandment, transition commandment, Shabbat, Sabbath, okay, which deals with both God and people. And then last week we shifted over to the second tablet when the fifth commandment, which was father, mother being the center of that. So today we get to easily one of the two most controversial commandments. Big part of the controversy is, how do you translate this? It's interesting. It was translated in the King James Bible one way for 400 years, and then in the 20th century, almost every single Bible, every single Protestant Bible changed the translation. The word, the key word was changed. Catholic Bibles did not until the CEB, the most contemporary Bible, and the one that replaces the NRSV, went back to the way it was before. So there's a little story here. So the CEB has what the old King James used to have. It's what I was raised on, you were probably raised on. How many of you are raised on that you shall not kill? Was anybody raised on something different? You shall not murder. You shall not murder, yeah. And we're going to be talking about that. Deuteronomy, exactly the same. CEB says you shall not kill, which is what the old translation was. Now, this seems pretty straightforward, doesn't it? Doesn't get much clearer than that, you know. No ifs, no ands, no buts, you just don't do this. Yet it's easily the most controversial and the most misunderstood of all the commandments. You know, here we go. The devil's in the details. You ever heard that? Yeah. You should not kill ... except under certain conditions. So it seems simple until you get in very specific things. It seems wrong. We've been taught to take human life, but what about times of war? By the way, I did not know this until this week. Not one time in the entire Bible, not once, is killing in times of war listed as a violation of this commandment. Not once. That shocked me, you know. Defending your family. Is that wrong? You know? Probably be very hard to find an American who disagree with that. What about someone at the end of their life, they have a terminal illness? Have you ever worked with hospice? You know, under hospice, where the morphine gives them comfort, there is a point where the morphine to give them comfort will terminate their life. Okay, and that's acceptable. Legally, it's acceptable in the medical community. It's acceptable by many families. So, you know, where is the line here? The command opens a Pandora's box of a controversial and emotionally charged social issues that you know. Capital punishment, a lot of energy around that. War, a lot of energy around that. Abortion, a lot of energy around that. Euthanasia. Anytime a human life is terminated, it's a highly emotional charge and highly controversial issue with people on both sides. So the question for us this morning as we look at this document that probably in terms of the tradition goes back close to 3,000 years, can something written far, you know, a long time ago in a different culture, can it give us any kind of useful guidance? Another time, another place. Shall we say it was a different world? Yeah. It's a radically different world, as we'll see. Many of the social issues we face today could not even be conceived of. They did not know about some of the medical decisions we can make today. Should we prolong life? We can. Should we? In the ancient world, that wasn't even an issue that got raised. You know, other issues like war, defending yourself, those issues remain the same. Then there's the issue I want to get into for just a minute of translating the original meaning of the command. For over 400 years in Western culture, Catholic and Protestant, The King James Bible and then also the Catholic Bible did the same thing at that time. The Sixth Commandment was usually read as "You shall not kill," and that was understood as a blanket prohibition against the taking of human life. So, if a Christian took this commandment literally in times of war, what could they be? Conscientious objector. Yes, Susan?
What about killing someone's soul by being unkind over a period of time?
Yeah.
For people to disparage other people.
This commandment is really about
kill someone inside, though.
Yeah. Legitimate issue, related issue, separate issue. Yeah.
Really?
Okay. This issue is really about the termination of a life. Yeah. Where they're breathing and then they're not because of an act that you took or an act that the culture took. But I know in the world I was raised in, it was understood as a blanket term. You shall not kill, just categorically across the board.
Animals.
What?
Animals have been brought into that too.
Yeah, that's another issue that we raised today. This commandment has not traditionally been understood as applying to that. This is the taking of human life, and we'll see an explanation in Deuteronomy, because only we are made how? In the image of God. And so the argument from Deuteronomy is we are unique, and that uniqueness gives us some rights. They're not unconditional. You can still take a human life, but the bar is considerably higher for that. This is literally what you see etched around courthouses across the country, even if most of those are fairly recent in our history. But did you grow up in a church with the Ten Commandments posted? I never saw one that said murder. They all, you know, you shall not kill, sanctuary, Sunday school classrooms, on the board. So, Sixth Commandment is referred to countless, I love this, you know, it's like, duh, what part of that doesn't make sense? Well, it turns out it's not quite as simple as this poster would make it be, you know. In Judaism, Christianity, and Islam, all three, you can take human lives. So here's the problem. There is no such commandment. That is a translation decision that was made with the King James Bible to translate a word. But if you go back to the original language, both, by the way, in Hebrew and in Greek, this is not just a Hebrew issue. This is all the languages used in the Bible, New Testament and Old Testament. Simply, that statement, you shall not kill, is never found in the Bible, either Testament, not once. It simply is not there. Which shook me up when I first learned that, you know. The Hebrew is clear. You shall not retsak. And retsak is sometimes translated kill or slay, but that's not what it means. It means to slay outside of the law. And we have a term for that. Murder. So it's a legal term. You can take a human life under certain circumstances, but you have to take it legally. You're forbidden from going outside the law and breaking the law. Mm-hmm. Yeah, Barbara asked that question last night. And the difference is this. One is inside the law and permitted. One is outside the law and forbidden. In our society, the same thing. Can we take a person's life through capital punishment? Now, should we not? That's a different issue. Can we? We can. Can you take a human life if somebody threatens your life inside your home? And there's a long list of those things. We acknowledge in our society that we can take a human life and it's justified. Or it's, that's kill. Murder's a legal term. And it means when there's a prohibition against it and I do it anyway in violation of prohibition, that transitions over into murder. And I know we got a lot of lawyers in the room, but is that how the law works for us as a society? Without justification. So murder, by definition, is without justification. If you have justification, it's not murder, correct? And my understanding is that's pretty much, go back to the Code of Hammurabi, you know, 8 centuries before Moses, and still the same kind of thing. Maybe not identical, but they seem to be related. Now, in Matthew, the text where Jesus quotes this commandment, the word, of course, Matthew writes in Greek, Jesus would have spoken in Hebrew or Aramaic, more likely. But the Greek word that's actually used there, the meaning is the same. What we have there in Matthew 5 is this. Have you heard that it was said of ancient times, you shall not murder? This is part of the Sermon on the Mount. Jesus is referencing this commandment that we're looking at, whether it's from Deuteronomy or from Exodus. And the word, Greek word there is phoneo. Again, it's not about, that word is never used for just killing generally. It is referred to killing without justification, outside the law, what we would call the term murder. So both command, both testaments. Now, the issue being addressed in the biblical text, in the Bible we have, Old Testament, New Testament, is the prohibition against the taking of life. And it's not categorical. It's not any or all circumstances. It is outside the law. It is what we generally refer to by the term of murder. Now, that's reflected in most modern translations of the Bible. Those, all the ones in black, these are basically recent, meaning the last 30 or 40 years, English translations of the Bible. What do they all have in the black? Murder, 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 murder. The NAB, New American Bible, and the NJB, the New Jerusalem Bible, are Catholic Bibles. It's interesting. The Catholic Bibles are consistent with murder, and the Protestant Bible, consistent with kill, and the Protestant Bibles are consistent with murder. The standout there is the CEB, the brand new Bible that came out like 4 or 5 years ago, the one that we are going to be using in our church in the future. And what's interesting about that is that was a collaborative Bible put out by the Catholic and the Protestants together. And it's interesting that the word goes back to the old King James, you shall not kill. And that just sort of jumps out at you. It's sort of, you know, when I read that, it was like, what was going on with that kind of thing? Why did we jump back, you know? The footnote in the CEB says, or murder. So hedging our bets there. That it could go, kind of implies it could go either way. But clearly, the idea is it's outside the law. This surprises some people. Contrary to some views, the taking of human life is permitted in the Bible. It is not prohibited. Unlawful taking is, but simply the taking of human life. Now, I was raised kind of a different understanding, were you? That the Bible essentially would not, in other words, no taking of human life would be justified. And that works until you read. And in Genesis forward, you know. And it's not prohibited in Ten Commandments. It's even mandated. We've been seeing some of those. If you break this law, what happens? Yeah, the penalty is death. Behind the Sixth Commandment, though, there is a core value that the Bible wants to lift up. Human life is valuable. It is valuable, and biblically speaking, precisely because the biblical understanding is uniquely, we might want to argue this, but uniquely we are made in the image of God. Now, as to what that means, you got, you know, 50,000 different variations of that. But because of this, the taking of human life is treated very seriously. So in Genesis 9, we have this. Whoever sheds the blood of a human, by human shall that person's blood be shed. Why? For his own image God made humankind. You do not indiscriminately take the life of something that's made in the image of God. Again, there's no attempt to apply this to animals. There's no attempt to apply it for less than the taking of human life. Now, you could imply that this lays down a principle that you could work with on that, but it's not there. It's not absolute. It's not conditional. So the irony here is that the very legislation that says human life is valuable is the very legislation that also says you can take it. It's valuable because we're in the image of God, but in certain circumstances you can take it. It also authorized the taking of human life. Not only is it limited to legality of the human life, there's another important way in which it's limited that some of you are very aware of. You've mentioned it to me before. You know the Ten Commandments were never intended to apply to everybody, right? We put them on court lawns because what's the implication? If you put it on a courthouse lawn, what are we saying? It's for everybody. And biblically speaking, that's not why they were written. They were limited in scope and application. They were in-house rules for within the community. The Ten Commandments are for who originally? Israel. This is not dealing with relations with foreign nations. This has to do with how the Jews treat each other as part of the covenant community that God has created. we are not allowed to unlawfully take the life of another Israelite. Okay? And so it's a much narrower focus. Some of us, that makes us uncomfortable, because I think we've understood that it's actually much broader than that. And I think the interpretation over the centuries has become much broader, but originally that was it. We have in the Bible numerous and troubling instances that Israel clearly understood God wants them to kill. You know that, right? There's just certain parts of the Bible you just should not read, okay? Just, yeah. The book of Joshua is first and foremost, okay, yeah. Do you remember the conquest of the land of Canaan? Joshua 11:11. And they put to the sword all who were in it, utterly destroying them. There was no one left who breathed, and he burned Hazor with fire. There's even a story where the Jews disobey God, sparing the women and children. Remember that story? And then God comes back at them and says, no, I said kill them all. And then God kills them for not killing them. And it's just one of those stories that will keep you up at night. Okay. Clearly, there's a big issue here. Is it God's will, or is it what they understood or thought that God's will? I tend to lean the second direction. I don't think that's God's will, but clearly they did it. And it's interesting, if you know history, what has been done when people thought it was God's will? And that just keeps going. You know, the Reformation, we saw a lot of that too. Time again, at Hazor, Jericho, Ai. You know, you just start reading that book there, and this is not an abnormality. This is the norm of that time. Mercy is not a concept that you found in the conquest of Palestine. It was ethnic cleansing. It was remove this people so this people could come and take the land. And if you will follow the news, we're still dealing with that. Yeah, we're still dealing with it. Continues to be the case throughout the Old Testament. Now, there are glimpses in the Old Testament where at first glance, this is the key, first glance, it looks like there might be something a little better there. Do you remember this? That sound a little better? Well, it is until you read it in context, okay? This is what it says if you actually read it in context. We add one more verse. You shall not hate in your heart your kin. Actually, that's harder than the other way. You got kin? Yeah, you got some kin? You shall not take vengeance or bear a grudge against your own people, you know. You shall love your neighbor as yourself. Now, in Jewish tradition, initially, who would the neighbor be? Yeah, it's your fellow Israelites, particularly your clan and your tribe, as they say. The language is restrictive. It's your people. It's your kin. So again, it's not as broad as we'd like it. Even the command to love your neighbors yourself is originally limited to Israelites. Now, sidebar, what did Jesus do with this? How about love your enemies? Yeah, and we're going to head there. We want to look at that. The sad truth, though, is for those who would like to find an enlightened modern view of violence, in the Old Testament, it's real hard to find. Now, there may be some stories in there you can kind of work with, but generally speaking, not so much. Now, to be fair, was Israel any different from anybody else? No. Code of Hammurabi, 18th century B.C., death penalty was required for 25 different crimes. I think that's more than we have now, right? Okay. It's also true for the Egyptians, the Hittites, the Assyrians, the Babylonians, the Greeks, and the Romans. So it's not that Israel was out of step with the culture or the times, but very much, I think this was a way of viewing it at the time. Interestingly, I mentioned this earlier, the Hebrew Bible never uses the word ritzak, murder, in connection with the taking of human life in war. There's got to be a book out there somewhere that kind of explores that, but I thought that was interesting. Okay, we turn to Jesus. His ministry is presented in the New Testament. Very quickly, you get a very, very sharp contrast. Not one clear instance of Jesus ever advocating violence, much less the taking of a life. Very famous passage in 26 that you know. With that, one of Jesus' companions reached for his sword. Remember, this is the Garden of Gethsemane. And another gospel, Luke identifies that companion as Peter. Drew his sword. He had a sword. Peter was packing. That's just interesting, you know. Yeah. Cut off the ear of the high priest. Jesus then says, put your sword back in its place, for all who draw the sword will die by the sword. And Jesus said to the crowd, am I leading a rebellion that you have to come out with clubs and swords to capture me? Now, one interesting story is that what is Peter doing with a sword? Anybody got an answer for that? This term is basically clearly a weapon. But if common sense says in the ancient world, if you're traveling around and you're not armed, you stand a good chance of not being here. So what we know from the culture, the common practice was, particularly if you were traveling, you would take something self-defense. You would take something to protect yourself. So we have another scripture that kind of deals with that. But there's some places where Jesus seems to advocate this. One interesting one is in Luke 22. He said to them, now he's talking to the disciples, he's going to send them out into the world, okay? This is before his death. Now, if you have a purse, take it. That's wise. Take some money with you. Take your bag. If you don't have a sword, sell your cloak and buy one. Ooh, I forgot that one. Okay, yeah. The disciples said, see, Lord, we got two. Jesus said, good boys. Is enough, does it mean, no, we shouldn't carry swords? Most likely, the commentator says, is he saying two is enough to defend you? You don't have to buy any more. Okay. Again, Jewish tradition, Christian tradition, this has been understood as kind of a common sense thing. And the word bandits, robbers, you know, prevalent. So you need to have some protection. So self-defense against robbers, Jesus seems to say that's okay. It implies that you might be able to take a life in defense of your own. That's not what Jesus says, but there are many people who say that seems to be that. Another troubling passage is found in Matthew 10. Do not think that I've come to bring peace on the earth. I've come not to bring peace, but a sword. Forgot about that one too. Okay, yeah. So what's going on there? Well, most likely, Jewish and Christian commentators across the century said this is meant to be metaphorical, because if you look at it, what's being talked about is that when the person decides to follow Jesus, it can create conflict within the family. Can I have an amen? Yeah. And the more serious you take it. So sword could then be a metaphor for tension, nonviolent conflict created by people following Jesus. Most likely that's what that's about. Sermon on the Mount, when Jesus finally gets to the sixth commandment, it's interesting because he does not deal with the act of killing. He just doesn't address it. Instead, he redirects it to something else. And you know this. You have heard that it was said of ancient times, you shall not murder. Whoever murders shall be liable for the judgment. What's the judgment? Death. It's kind of interesting. Even in that debate is in our justice system. Should you kill a person to send the message that you should not kill? Yeah. And that argument, you know, is out there. But I say to you, if you are angry with your brother or sister, you are already liable for the judgment. To this you can add Matthew 5. You have heard that it was said, love your neighbor, your enemy, and love your neighbor, hate your enemy. I tell you, love your enemies, pray for those that persecute you. And of course, Jesus goes on to say, even love your enemies. Yeah. Other than this, we don't have any teaching by Jesus on the sixth commandment. It's not a big issue he was addressing a lot. Now, what happens as you roll forward? Well, if we roll forward, the teaching of Jesus obviously carried a lot of weight. So, for example, in Paul, although he does not address the sixth commandment, he does what Jesus does. He deals with the inner motivations that might lead someone to take a life. And so Ephesians 4 says this, put away from all your bitterness and wrath and anger and wrangling and slander together with all malice. Because where would those lead you? They lead you down a road. Be kind to one another, tenderhearted, forgiving one another, as God in Christ has forgiven you. Therefore, be imitators of God as beloved children, and live in love as Christ loved us and gave himself up for us, a fragrant offering and sacrifice for God. You turn to Romans. Again, he does not specifically address the commandment itself, but he raises a similar issue, Romans chapter 12. Beloved, never avenge yourselves. One of the real issues in that part of the world is, what's the term? Where your family, somebody from another family kills your family member, and then your whole, what?
Family feud?
Family feud, but there's a term. What? It's honor, but... Vendetta. No, there's a technical term for it.
Blood feud.
Blood feud. Blood feud. That basically in a family or a clan, if someone from that clan injures somebody from our clan is obligated to strike back, which sets in play what? The cycle of violence. You know. Now, do we see any of that in the world? Yeah. Yeah. People who've been fighting each other for centuries. Yeah. Leave room for the wrath of God. For it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. So who's the one that should sort this out? God, not us. That's not up to us to do. No, if your enemies are hungry, feed them. If they are thirsty, give them something to drink. For by doing this, I love this, you will heap burning coals in their heads. You really want to get them back? Be kind to them, you know. Kill them with kindness. Overcome evil with good. As with the Ten Commandments, though, when you start looking at this stuff, again, these are all understood in-house. Just as Israel had in-house rules, the Christian community had in-house rules. It applies within the community. Outside the community, it was not as clear. Not originally meant as general moral principles in every situation. Now, Jesus does stand out, though, uniquely for applying all of this to the enemies. It's interesting. Before Jesus and after Jesus, it seems to be softer than it was with Jesus. Jesus seems to draw the line. And as you go either direction, the line gets a little bit blurred. Later Christian tradition follows the example of the Old Testament, focusing on illegal killing rather than killing itself. And it's also true that the early church, this is an interesting thing because this, for many centuries, in the earliest centuries, Christians were known for their refusal to serve in the military. Flat out. Because if you served in the military, you were required to kill. And it's interesting, in the early church, the sixth commandment was understood by early Christians as, I will violate that commandment and I'll violate the teaching of Jesus if I do something that requires me to take a human life. Now, all that leaves a latitude for individual Christians and churches and a wide variety. Some of you know, for example, there's a doctrine in the Catholic Church called just war theory. You can go to war and be justified if certain criteria are met. If those criteria are not met, the war is unjustified. So this legal principle seems to kind of come across. Now, let's look at the social principles of the United Methodist Church. Always fun to play in this playground. And what you see here, how would you get 1,000 Methodists to agree? Which is what General Conference is, okay? And you see this issue gets played out in an interesting way. For example, what about war? What do you think? Are we for it or against it? How about both? We believe war is incompatible with the teachings and example of Christ. Is that pretty straight on? Okay. We therefore reject war as an instrument of national foreign policy. Pretty straight on. It is to be employed only as a last resort. What? We're against it. It's incompatible with Christian teaching, but we can do it as a last resort. In the prevention of such evils as genocide, brutal suppression of human rights, and unprovoked international aggression. Now, I don't know about you, but I actually would support that. I mean, many of us would. Even though the first part of it, I also support. So there's an ambiguity there. War is incompatible with Christian teaching, the example of Christ. However, it can be employed And the terminology is very clear, as a last resort. You don't start there, but you might be driven there to some point. What about serving in the military? Anybody here besides me grew up during the Vietnam War? Okay. A lot going on back then. So there's been several shows recently about the Vietnam War. The one last week was 1968. Did y'all see that? It's the year I graduated from high school and started college. It was like very emotional to watch that. We also acknowledge that many Christians believe that when peaceful alternatives have failed, the force of arms may regrettably be preferable to unchecked aggression, tyranny, and genocide. Hitler, Stalin, yeah.
Are we going back to that single word, justification?
Justification, maybe once, not in the sense of salvation, being made right with God, but in the legal sense of maybe, are you justified in making this decision? Are there sufficient grounds for that? Are there warrants for that kind of thing? That seems to be what the language is here is saying. What it does is it say it's wrong, but it lives open the possibility that we live in a sinful, broken, fallen world, and we have to deal with that world. And we deal with that world in ways that are not optimal, would be my understanding of how that is. Kind of thing. We honor the witness of pacifists who will not allow us to become complacent about war and violence, but look at this. We also respect those who support the use of force, but only in extreme situations. Do we support pacifists? Yes. Do we support those who choose to serve in the military? Yes, we do. There's an ambiguity there. And only when the need is clear beyond reasonable doubt and through appropriate international organizations. Abortion, hot topic. We believe in the sanctity of unborn human life. Makes us, what's the most important word on that slide? Reluctant to approve, which means what? Under certain conditions. Okay. We are equally bound to respect the sacredness of the life and well-being of the mother, for whom devastating damage may result from an unacceptable pregnancy. That's not a medical argument. That's more of a sociological or an emotional argument kind of thing. In continuity with past Christian teaching, we recognize tragic conflicts of life and life with life may justify abortion. Suicide and euthanasia. This is one we've had to deal with in our congregation many times because many of us know that multiple members of our church have committed suicide. And we've had many funerals here with that. And this slide here puts us somewhat at odds with most of the other voices in our community. A Christian perspective on suicide begins with an affirmation of faith that nothing, including suicide, separates us from the love of God. Therefore, we deplore the condemnation of people who commit suicide. That stands in sharp contrast to some other voices that say, if you commit suicide, what happens to you? You're going to hell. We do not believe that. And we consider unjust the stigma that also falls on the surviving family members. The church opposes assisted suicide and euthanasia. So the way the social principles work is they are the statement of the church, but they're non-binding. You don't have to agree with it, but it is the only statement of the church that stands out there. So assisted suicide is not something that we as a church support, although individuals may have to deal with that. Death penalty. We oppose the death penalty, capital punishment, and urge its elimination from all criminal codes. Now, what's interesting about this is that's it. No equivocation. That's the only one that there's no equivocation on. We oppose the death penalty. Now, here's the question. Methodists are accused of being wishy-washy. Is that what this is? Or is it realism? It would be wonderful, maybe it wouldn't be wonderful, depends on your theology, but some people would like to have a biblical text they could go through that would survive, you know, would give you the answer. Can't find it. What we find is a latitude, and what we find with contemporary Christians like our own church is a struggle with how are we faithful to God, how are we faithful to Christ, how are we faithful to the Ten Commandments, but in the situations that we live in. So unfortunately, you shall not kill is not quite as simple as my Sunday school teacher in elementary school told me. Okay. It's a little more complicated than that, you know. Even if it's the Ten Commandments or the teaching of Jesus. So next week we'll look at adultery, but we got a little bit of time here. And I know this is a hot button. Yes.
What was the discussion around the stance on capital punishment?
Do not know. I was not at General Conference that year. Barbara actually went to General Conference one year. Barbara, the year you were there, were they dealing with this? Capital punishment? Yeah. The original social justice principles were written in 72 because we had the Union in 68. So we had the new doctrine in 72. I know the doctrine was rewritten in 92. Baptism was also rewritten. To my knowledge, I don't know that the social principles have been rewritten since 72. There's been attempts, like on homosexuality, attempts to change it, but those essentially, both sides sort of neutralized each other, yeah. Now, Paul does say, because Paul is arguing prior to any persecution by Rome of Christians. When Paul writes that, there has been no Christian. So Paul sees, and this is in Romans, Paul sees the state as providing a very beneficial function. Y'all agree with that? At least in theory, yeah. That the state is preferable to anarchy. And so Paul urges... And this, matter of fact, in the New Testament, several books, we are urged to basically place ourselves under the authority of the state and to abide by the laws. I don't remember specifically on that particular issue, but that's the general picture, yeah. We benefit from that. Now, biblically, you have to also argue that a little bit later when the state persecutes, like the book of Revelation, the state becomes Satan. So you have both those traditions in there. But Paul was writing prior to, and he's writing as a Roman citizen. He's writing as a person who benefits immensely, as many people did. I mean, if Rome was against you, it was bad. But for most citizens of the Roman Empire, I mean, you had roads, you had water, you had health, you know, you had a lot of really, really good things as a result of that. So, yeah. Do not know. I've not really researched that. So, I would imagine that the Lutherans and the Presbyterians would have statements. Congregational churches like Baptists probably would be more of an independent church type position. But if you have a denomination that has a sort of central position, that'd be a good thing to research, though. Susan?
I think Jesus called us to living higher than the law. He called us to a higher law. And he said to render unto Caesar what is Caesar, but God is God. Mm-hmm. And if he is the protector of our faith and the example of our faith, he chose to go to the cross rather than be violent. Mm-hmm.
Not one example of Jesus ever advocating violence. And that really stands out. Yeah. 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 And I think Susan's right that within the Christian community, the belief is New Testament trumps Old Testament. Jesus trumps Torah, and the Ten Commandments. It's interesting that we keep trying to go back here a lot and just have to be aware of that. I think the grounding of the teaching of Jesus is where we go. That's where we stand, yeah. Lots of issues here. Yes, Barbara. All three faiths. I know within Islam and Judaism, the position of Islam is not that different from Judaism. There are restrictions, but then there are exceptions. But I think Susan's right. When you turn to the teaching of Jesus, he seems to be the one place where there's not equivocation. The one place where it stands firm. Yeah. Would be nice to have more explicit teaching on that, but the lack of any reference to him ever using violence or ever advocating violence, his advocating that we are called to love the enemy, that we basically are called to sacrifice ourselves for the other. There's a fairly consistent thread that runs through that.
What about when he picked up the whip and cleaned out the temple?
Yeah, yeah.
That's a little violent.
Yeah, yeah. And you got to deal with that text, yeah. And there are those who would argue he was provoked. Yeah, yeah. But he didn't take a human life, which is a little bit different issue. It's that one act really stands out as distinctly different from anything else, which should draw attention to it and say, okay, something's going on there that really provoked.
You've given us several Ten Commandments to refer to this, refer to that. Do you have one that you have adopted to say that this is what I think is false?
Not in the Ten Commandments. I'm like Susan. I've got to go back to basically the love commandment and the call to even love the enemy. I think, for me personally, the epitome of the teaching of Jesus and the most radical thing he ever said was the call to love the enemy. And I think that is probably the single hardest thing anybody can do, because it's absolutely contrary to the Old Testament, which was, what do you do with your enemy? Yeah, yeah, literally. I mean, you go to war, you fight, and you're justified. And I don't think we can get justification from Jesus in that at all. Yeah. But on several topics, divorce being another one, is so interesting that Jesus' stands are so radical that later Christian tradition struggles with accepting it. For example, in divorce, Jesus said no. Period. No ifs, ands, or buts. And ever since then, Christians have been struggling. What do we do with divorce? You know, next week it's adultery, taking human life. And Jesus's standard is just really, really high. And people of faith who take that seriously, there's no easy answer. You have to live into that gap and try to figure out, how am I a faithful disciple of Jesus given the situation that we're in? And one of the things Methodists affirm is we affirm that Christians can legitimately and honestly disagree. That we both in faithfulness can come to an issue, we both walk away at different places, and we're both attempting to be faithful. So it's not that you're right and I'm wrong, or I'm right and you're wrong. It's that there is a latitude there that as Christians struggle. Yeah, it's the issue of discipleship. Well, we run the clock out. I know we got some people coming behind us, so our closing is
4:10.
4:10, all right.